go, please, to Isaiah chapter 4. Isaiah chapter 4. We noted last time that in all of the prophets there is a thread that goes all the way through, and that is the fact that Israel is God's chosen people, and every single prophet that announces judgment on Israel also comes along and announces the restoration of Israel. And we're just at the tail end of one of those sections that has talked about the sinfulness of Israel, and that came down through chapter 4 and verse 1. Now, finishing that out, and before we start into a new section, verses 2 through 6 talks about the restoration of Israel as follows. Verse 2. In that day, and we'll want to focus on that particular expression because that's going to become very important in the Old Testament. What is that day? What day are we talking about? So in that day, the branch of the Lord. And that really is going to be, in the book of Isaiah, our first bit of messianic prophecy, looking forward to the coming of Christ. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel, and so forth, describing that glorious day. So, under the idea, then, of Israel's restoration, which is the theme of Isaiah 4, 2 through 6, the first thing we get is a time fix. This restoration will be in that day. The expression, that day, is a reference to the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is mentioned often in the Old Testament, and sometimes referred back to as that day, the great day, or something of that sort. That day, then, a reference to the day of the Lord. And the first thing we know about that day is it is not a 24-hour day. It's not a 24-hour period. It is a span of time. Now, when we say that, how do we know that the day of the Lord is not a 24-hour period, but is rather a span of time? How do we know that? Well, the answer to how we know that is simply this. Take all of the passages in the Old Testament that refer to that day, that great day, the day of the Lord, pull them together, and see what events are covered. So, what we have to work with, then, is about 75 references in the Old Testament. And the question to ask is, looking at those 75 references, what events are included in the day of the Lord? What things happen then? What events are included? And when we get our answer to what events are included, then we'll have some idea of the period of time that is covered, or the span of time that's covered by the day of the Lord. Now, right in the immediate context, we can say this. In the immediate context, by looking at Isaiah 3:18, and by looking at Isaiah 4:2, we can say that that period is going to include two important things. First of all, going back to 3:18. Says, in that day the Lord will take away the beauty of anklets, headbands, crescent ornaments, and so forth. And so 18 sounds one of the notes that are involved in the day of the Lord. Many, many times the day of the Lord involves judgment. In fact, you can go through these 75 passages, and probably the majority of them, when it talks about the day of the Lord, is describing events of terrible judgment. But that's not all. If we would stop at that point, we would say, what is the day of the Lord? The day of the Lord is the day of judgment. And that's true, but it's only half true. And the reason it's only half true is because of chapter 4, where we just read in verse 2. Because not only will there be judgment, but in that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious and so forth. Down at verse 3. It will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion. So it's a day of judgment when Israel is cleaned up, when she's purged of the bloodshed coming from their midst. Then, verse 5, the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over assemblies, and then it describes His protective power. And therefore, you've got, then, in chapter 4, verse 2, you've got the presence of the Lord, and you have blessing. And if you take those three ideas, you can take the 75 passages in the Old Testament and say this: the day of the Lord is a day of judgment on Israel, it's a day of the presence of the Lord in a personal way, and it's a day when His blessing is outpoured on men. Therefore, the whole span of what the Old Testament calls the day of the Lord is the time when the Lord returns in judgment to purge and discipline His people Israel and to set up His kingdom and pour out blessing on earth. Therefore, we have just come out of the book of Revelation, and we have noted in Revelation we had, remember, a sequence, and it was our three simple R's: a period of divine wrath, followed by the return of Christ, followed by the reign of Christ. And therefore, I would take the day of the Lord and say the day of the Lord is this period right here. It is the period of judgment. It is the period that involves and includes the return of Christ. And it's a period that includes the reign of Christ. And the way, again, that is determined is by taking all of the day of the Lord passages, pulling them together and saying, what are the events that are put under the umbrella of the day of the Lord? And there are your events. It's God's wrath, that's involved. The presence of Christ, that's involved. The blessing of God on Israel, that's involved. And within the scope then of those passages then, we have a period of time that is referred to in and under the umbrella of the return of the day of the Lord. So the day of the Lord begins with the events of the tribulation and includes the return of Christ on through His reign. All right, then the first thing we get going back to Isaiah 4 is a time fix. He's talking about the ultimate day of the Lord. The second thing we get in Isaiah 4:2 is not only a time fix, but we get a messianic reference. And the messianic reference is, in that day, the branch of the Lord. And the first thing we note is that in the Old Testament, the coming of the Messiah is pictured as a branch. So let's look at some of the branch passages where the coming of Christ, the Messiah, is pictured under the imagery of a branch. Jeremiah 23. Jeremiah 23 is the first branch passage. 23, 5, and 6. Now, when we talk about messianic passages, think of the two comings of Christ as two mountain peaks, like this. Obviously exaggerated mountain peaks. This is the first coming of Christ. This is the second coming. And the Old Testament prophets look at His first and second coming. And let's put on this two figures back here. We will put the Old Testament prophet. Looks down time to the first and second coming of the Messiah. We also look at the same thing, only we look at it from a different perspective. We are not back here looking forward to the first and second because the first has already occurred. We are here. And that's one of the important things to remember about studying the Old Testament, is that we have a different perspective than they did. Isaiah, and we'll see lots. As a matter of fact, if you want to describe the suffering of Christ on the cross, no place does it better than Isaiah 53. Very vivid type thing. And we'll find, well, as we did last week in Isaiah 2, if you want a description of the condition of what will happen when Christ returns, You can't do better than Isaiah chapter 2. But the perspective is different. And the perspective being simply that in the Old Testament, they looked forward to two comings. We look back to one, the first coming of Christ, and forward to the second. Now, that being the case, we are able to distinguish, and again, if these were literal mountains, who would best be able to distinguish mountaintops? Obviously, the person that is standing in between could look back to one and forward to the other, and it would be very easy to distinguish the two. However, put yourself back here. Have you ever done this in Colorado? You see a mountain, and then you see behind it another one, and it looks like the other one must be hugging the one that's toward the front, only to come out to find out what? That the one that you see in the background is 200 miles away from the one that you see in the foreground. In other words, you lose perspective of distance between the two when you look from this angle. And therefore, when the Old Testament prophets write about the coming of Christ, what happens? First and second coming blend right into one. And while we can sit here and say, well, why didn't Isaiah said that's the first coming, this is the second? Well, his perspective was different. He's looking from a different angle. And we have to remember that whenever we study any time in the Old Testament prophets, the way it comes together, and therefore they often blend, whereas for us we have a different perspective. So, coming to Jeremiah chapter 23 and verse 5. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I shall raise up for David a righteous branch. He will reign as king and act wisely. All right, that's obviously messianic. What mountain peak is he looking at? Well, we know which one he's looking at because the first coming of Christ was one that involved suffering. And we look forward to his second coming that involves his reigning. And so Isaiah in verse 5, behold, the days are coming. And again, keep in mind that to Isaiah, the distance between mountain peaks, he does not know. That is obscured because he's looking from a different angle. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch. He shall reign as king and act wisely, do justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely. And this is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. Therefore, notice then in Jeremiah's passage, he gives us four things about this coming Messiah. First, in verse 5, I will raise up for David a righteous branch. Number one, he says something about his genealogical connection. That one that is to fill this role will be of the house of David. When we begin in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, that relates to the coming of Christ, you begin to read through the chapter, and probably you'll read a few verses into it, skim through the rest of it, and go to chapter 2. Why? Because chapter 1 of Matthew is essentially so-and-so begat and begat and begat and begat and begat. If you go to the book of Luke over at chapter 3 and begin to read, you'll read a little bit and you'll begin to find out you're in genealogical territory. And it's so-and-so was the father of, and so-and-so was the son of, and the son of, and the son of. And I doubt that anybody sitting here spends a lot of detailed time memorizing who begat who, if we read it at all. Well, what then is the reason? Well, the reason is to establish that this person, Jesus Christ, has the genealogical connection that the Old Testament requires. And therefore, when Jeremiah says this one has to be of, is going to be raised up from the line of David, the New Testament is careful to say, let's be sure that we can trace this one Messiah back to David, because if we can't, he is not the Messiah. He's got to have genealogical credentials. Second, notice also in verse 5, he will reign as king. So he has a genealogical connection. he has a royal position. Now that helps us to give the prophecy a time fix. That helps us to put the coming of Christ at the second mountain peak. And so Jeremiah, while he may see the first and second coming blended together, we know from our perspective between the first and second coming that the royal position is yet future, and between those two mountain peaks there has been a great deal of time that has passed. As a matter of fact, we can go back to the mountain peaks and we can say so far between the first one and the second one it's at least 2,000 miles years between the two, and we're still holding and anticipating that that period may soon come to an end, but we do not know. God knows the number between the mountain peaks. We do not know, and I'm sure Isaiah had no clue. You mean between that suffering of the Messiah and his reigning as king, there is 2,000 years and we're still on hold? And Isaiah would be surprised. If you'd said to Isaiah, do you mean that between his suffering and his reign, there's much time? And Isaiah probably would have said, no, I see them as following one another very, very quickly. That wasn't the case, but that was part of the perspective of the prophets. So the branch then is going to come out of David. The branch will be royal. And then notice one of the emphases on his character is in the last part of verse 5. He will do justice and righteousness in the land. And then the last part of verse 6, his name is to be called the Lord our righteousness. And so the emphasis is genealogical connection, royal position, righteous character. And fourth, in the days of Judah, in his days, Judah will be saved. Israel will dwell securely. And this is his name by which he will be called. And the emphasis is on his personal relationship to Israel. He will bring about her salvation. First branch passage. Over just a few pages, Jeremiah 33. Second branch passage, Jeremiah 33, and in essence it is the same. 33:14-16. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the good word which I have spoken concerning the house of Israel and the house of Judah. In those days, and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice and righteousness in the earth. Notice the extent of his reign is emphasized here. It will be not only in Judah and Israel, but worldwide. In those days, Judah will be saved, and Jerusalem will dwell in safety. And this is the name by which he'll be called, the Lord is our righteousness. Zechariah, next to the last book of the Old Testament. Zechariah 3. Zechariah 3. We're going to look at four branch passages. A question really ought to be working in your mind, and that is, why is Christ called a branch? And you'll have lots of titles, but why is he called a branch? Why is that appropriate? And we'll answer that just as soon as we finish the branch passages. Zechariah 3:8. In Zechariah 3, the nation of Israel has been presented in the person of the high priest, Joshua. And in verse 8 we said, listen, Joshua the high priest, you and your friends who are sitting in front of you, indeed they are men who are assembled, for I, behold, am going to bring in my servant, the branch. For behold, the stone that I have set before Joshua, on one stone are seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave an inscription on it, declares the Lord of hosts. And I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to center to his vine and under his fig tree. And notice you have a time of peace
when Israel is aligned correctly, and so forth. Over a page to chapter 6, verses 12 and 13. Then say to him, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, a man whose name is Branch, for he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of the Lord. Yes, it is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he who will bear the honor, sit and rule on his throne. Thus he will be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace will be between the two offices. Priest and king, again, a messianic reference. Now, Christ then is called the branch, and therefore coming off of the branch passages, then we ought to ask a question. And the question, very simply, is this. Why is the word branch used for a description of Christ? Well, Isaiah likes the word branch, and he uses the verb places elsewhere, and the usage is this. It is used to describe, and we'll be able to establish this by passages, it is used to describe projects sponsored by the Lord. That's the use of the word. It's used for projects sponsored by the Lord. Now, let's take a look at that. Just in Isaiah, beginning with chapter 42. And notice in every one of these contexts, the theme is the same. Something is about to happen, and it issues out of the Lord. It is part of His project. He sponsors it. In other words, it's used to describe things that are not man-produced, but God-produced. And that would be appropriate, would it not? The branch comes, who is Christ, and He comes to do what? To execute God's program. To do those things that are sponsored by the Lord. To bring in righteousness, to bring in justice. And so forth. So, chapter 42 and verse 9. Now, the translation of the word branch will be slightly different, but we're working with the same word in a verb form. God says, behold, the former things have come to pass. Now I, the Lord, declare new things. God is about to embark on a project. Before they, and there is our word, branch forth, I proclaim them to you. And the word spring forth is the verb form of the noun branch. And so they will branch forth. And what is the theme there? God is about to do something Himself. And as He is about to do something Himself, He uses the expression, it's going to branch forth, because it's a project sponsored by the Lord. Across the page, chapter 43 and verse 19. Now, let me take this little statement and expand it a little further, because there's another note in the way Isaiah uses these words, or the word for branch. It's used not only to describe a project sponsored by the Lord, but there's something additional. And carried out by the Messiah. Or, we'll use the word for Messiah, carried out by Christ. Thus, if He is the one who carries forth God's program, He then is the branch, and thus the appropriateness of the term. 43:19. Behold, I will do something new. And notice the break. A project is about to break forth. Now it will branch forth, spring forth, our translation. Will you not be aware of it? I will make a roadway in the wilderness, rivers in the desert, descriptive of conditions during the reign of Christ. Chapter 55, verse 10. The Lord again speaking, as the rain and the snow come down from heaven, Do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout, and furnishing in seed to the sower and bread to the eater. So shall my word be which goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me empty without accomplishing what I desire. The words which goes forth, again, come to our verb for the idea of branching, of a branch. The word which branches out of my mouth, it shall not return to me empty without accomplishing what I desire, without succeeding in the matter which I've sent it. And so the emphasis is, I've got a project, it's new, it's going to be sponsored by me, and it will be successful for that reason, and it is the going forth of my word. Chapter 61, final.
61, 12 and 13. 61, 11, not 12, 13. For as the earth brings forth its sprouts, and the garden causes the thing sown in it to spring up, so the Lord will cause righteousness and praise to branch out, spring up, translation, before all the nations. And thus, God is going to bring about righteousness and peace and justice. It's going to come forth like a branch on a tree. It will spring forth, and the branch will be the one who will execute it. So back to chapter 4. Describing that glorious day. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious. The fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. Who are they? Survivors of Israel are a reference to the remnant. The faithful few, those who under the time of God's wrath are positive toward His word. And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. When the Lord has... And when will this come about? Well, these beautiful conditions will come about when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. Notice here we've got enormous blessing, but we've got also judgment and burning. And that all happens when? What are the first three words of verse 2? In that day. That's all part of the day of the Lord. Both judgment in verse 4, spirit of judgment, presence of the Lord, verse 2, and blessing of the Lord, verses 5 and 6. All of those things are elements of the day of the Lord. Then, verse 5, the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke and the brightness of a flaming fire by night, and for all the glory will be a canopy, and there will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day, and a refuge and a protection from the storm and from the rain. Now, in closing out this little section of blessing and restoration of Israel, and before we start with a brand new idea in chapter 5 and chapter 6, by the way, chapter 6, and I don't know that we'll get to it today. Chapter 6 is a gold mine. The things to be learned in this section are just absolutely breathtaking, at least I've found. Because in chapter 6, up to this point, Isaiah looks at Israel and she's undone. God shows him the future of Israel and it's bright. And then it's just as though God takes the first five chapters, sets them aside, and says, Isaiah, now see me. And we'll have a flash of autobiography in chapter 6. And the important and instructive thing will be what happens when a man sees God. And Isaiah will see the Lord in His holiness. And in the light of His holiness, he will look at himself. And that will be of tremendous importance. We'll spend a great deal of time on that. Because whoever measures himself by the standard of God's holiness. That's exactly what Isaiah is going to do in chapter 6. He's going to measure himself by the standard of God's holiness. And that is really, when we begin to think through the implications of that, they're mind-shaking. For example, in terms of salvation and in terms of the Christian life, first of all, in terms of salvation, what happens when a sinner looks at himself in the light of the holiness of God? Well, he should come to the same place that Isaiah will come to in chapter 6,
and he will say, I am wiped out. And he should come to the place of saying, in the light of God's holiness, I am wiped out. There is nothing left for me in terms of salvation. And he should come to a place of absolute hopelessness as far as achieving our salvation is concerned. And then, of course, something great can happen at that point. In the Christian life, what happens when we begin to measure ourselves continually by the holiness of God? And we don't do that. Transforming, if we do, we measure ourselves, and Christians measure themselves by all kinds of phony standards. I'm better off than those Christians. Who cares? Doesn't make any difference. I can see the sin in his life because I have righteous insight. Big deal. How do we look measured up to the holiness of God? And when we do that, we will find some very transforming concepts, but, well, we're not there yet, but this will be a tremendous chapter for really aligning the way we ought to look at ourselves, and just to see how much we do it, just in your own mind, I'll do it for myself, you do it for yourself and no one else, but how many times this week have you measured your conduct, your thoughts, in the light of and by the standard of the holiness of God? Or have we ever? And that will be one of the transforming things I think that will happen, I hope, to us when we get over to chapter 6, a very refreshing, helpful way to look at ourselves, as Isaiah will do so in the 6th chapter. But nonetheless, closing out now chapter 4. Notice in chapter 4, it closes out by, in verse 5, the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and her assemblies a cloud by day. Now, what does the cloud image do for us? What would it do for them? First place, where does the cloud over Israel take your mind? It takes it back, doesn't it? So the first thing the cloud does is it establishes continuity with Israel's past. Remember how God led them through the wilderness with the cloud? Well, God is saying in the future it will be no different. It's saying, what I started, I will finish. What I started, I will finish. I started to lead you by a cloud and you rebelled. The day will come is that I will cleanse you and I will again lead you. And there will be continuity with the past, tying in what is coming with what is past. And I guess we could say, well, I thought God leading them by the cloud didn't work out too well because of the rebellion. That's true. But did we think God quit? God chose His people and God finishes with His people. This is sort of the Philippians 1. He that has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. And that's a principle. God starts a relationship and we may rebel against it. He may be disciplined by removing the blessings of that relationship, but God does not quit, ever. When He establishes relationship with these people, He completes it. And the glory of this passage is, we really messed up under the cloud, but God is not done leading His people, and He will yet do it in Mount Zion. So it reminds them and gives them continuity. Second, by the way, in the book of Isaiah, is an announcement of judgment being made? You bet it is. In fact, we'll come over to the next chapter and he will going to say the Assyrian armies are on the alert. They don't sleep. They're in top condition. None of them are sick. They're ready to fight and they're marching and they're going to wipe you out. What does this do? It reminds us that God disciplines, but He never disciplines by severing His relationship. That is always, always there. And by the way, that carries a lesson for discipline within the home, is that discipline for children is so important, and punishment is often so important. But it is always punishment within the framework of what? Relationship. Always within the framework of your parents. We are your parents now, we will always be your parents. We are your father and your mother, and we will discipline severely, but you're still family member. God does exactly the same thing with Israel. And he says, I'm going to wipe you out and drag you in the mud and tear you in pieces like a lion. Then I'll restore you. He never threatens relationship severed. Second, in the cloud represented the presence of God with his people. So this cloud that is yet to come reaffirms God's desire to be present with his people. It reaffirms God's desire, namely, to be personally present with his people. And going back, this reiterates that thought to them again. And thus, the future of Israel. Now, chapter 5, we'll have a shift in the theme, and we'll pick up with that in our next study. Father, we're thankful for your word, for your love toward us, and that though you discipline, that we are still your own, and the relationship is still there. And we're thankful that this is true with Israel, and also with us, in Christ's name. Amen.